Hey everybody, welcome to the Yes Have Some podcast channel. Thank you so much for subscribing and for tuning in to YHS. We've got our regular Yes Have Some episode dropping here in the next day or two, but before that, we've got something a little different for you, something a little special, a little treat. Right now, we are going to be giving you a full YHS Patreon bonus episode. Now, this episode was originally only available to our Patreon subscribers. If you would like to become part of the YHS Patreon family, we would love to have you, because people ask all the time, what is the best way that we could support YHS as we grow and we have all of these additional shows and as we build up to Ghostbusters Afterlife and all the coverage that comes along with it? People want to be part of this community and it's awesome. And people ask how they can support. The best way and the most beneficial way for you is to join us on Patreon, because not only are you supporting us with a few dollars a month, which helps us keep the lights on and pay the bills and all the live streaming and all the equipment and all the stuff that goes along with podcasting, but you benefit from it because you get bonus content. So we've got the $5 tier where you get our bonus audio episodes 2 to 3 a month. Then we've got a $10 tier where you get all of that plus an additional bonus audio episode and the Discord and the watch along. And then we've got our $30 Merch Madness tier where you get once a quarter everything we offer on Patreon, but also the exclusive YHS merch drop only available to people on that Patreon tier. Our first one is coming up in just a few short weeks. Man, that's how you do it. So if you want to support us, join the Patreon. And if you've never listened to our Patreon content before, if you've never joined a Patreon and have no idea what it is, we wanted to give you a little preview. So the audio episodes that we do on Patreon can be anything. And there, sometimes it's just one of us getting on there and ranting and raving about Ghostbusters or about toys. Sometimes it's a full-fledged breakdown of a movie. Sometimes it's kind of similar to a regular YHS episode. Sometimes it's just a recorded phone call between Jake, Abigail, and myself. Really, Patreon allows us to do all sorts of stuff and experiment with new kinds of audio content, and it's a lot of fun. This particular episode that you're about to hear was something really cool that we got really good feedback on. It's Jacob Walsh, yes, our very own host of Yes Have Some Podcast, Jacob Walsh, with, I don't even know what to call this, an audio journey through The Mist, Stephen King's The Mist, the book, as well as the film, the Frank Darabont film. Jake is a huge fan of those, and he basically put something together, turned out really cool, really special, and we wanted everybody to hear it. We got really good feedback on it, like I said, and we think this will give you a little bit of a taste of the kind of stuff we're doing on Patreon. So if you like it, check us out on patreon.com/yeshavesome, and if you can't join us on Patreon, that's okay. We still want you to listen to this and let us know what you think, because it's really fun. And I don't want to give too much away. So without further ado, here is Jacob Walsh versus The Mist on Yes Have Some Podcast.
Sometime in the late 70s in a small town in Maine, a man sat through a thunderstorm. Now, thunderstorms are not a rare occurrence, I know, but sometimes they're different. Now, I'm talking about the ones that seem extra loud, violent. The wind howls and screams. All the light is sucked away except for the super bright flashes of lightning. They make you feel helpless, scared, like when you were a child. They almost feel supernatural, one of those storms. Well, the next morning, the man goes to the supermarket, still thinking about the storm. What if it was something more? What if it was supernatural? What if it released something into our world? What would you do? How would you survive? First published in 1980, and then included in 1985's Skeleton Crew, that man was Stephen King. And this is The Mist. Wow, talk about dramatic, huh? Hi, everybody. Welcome. Thank you for joining me here. My name's Jacob Walsh, and you know, thank you for joining this special episode of the Yes Have Some podcast, where I'm just going to be talking about The Mist. Clearly, if you were paying attention, you know this. The Mist, it's one of my favorite Stephen King adaptations of all time. I'd maybe put it in a top three. Maybe it would change depending on my thoughts and my feelings, but right now, it's up there. It might be my number one favorite adaptation. I don't know. We will see. We're going to get through this together. I'm going to be talking about the book here. I'm going to be talking about the movie. We're going to do this. I'm going to go through the plot. You know, not a lot of differences between the book and the movie. I will point them out as we get to them. I'm going to be going back and forth, just giving you the general plot. There's definitely going to be some spoilers here, so if you don't want to be spoiled, then what the fuck are you doing? Shut this off, go watch it, go read it, then come back to me, and I'll just wait on you. We're going to wait right now. Cool, so thank you for coming back. I'm going to say a lot as well. Last time I did one of these that was by myself, I went back and listened to it, and I was mortified at the amount of times I said I've been podcasting for over 5 years. I'm on three different shows. Why am I doing that? Is that how I talk in real life? I'm sorry. I'm derailing this already. Please forgive me. The Mist. Cool. Here we go. Now, if you haven't read this book, I say check it out. It's a novella. It's not very long. You could go through this in maybe 3 hours or so. I recently reread it. I recently rewatched the movie, so it would all be fresh in my head. Now, the movie, I've rewatched it plenty of times. I don't need to sit here and tell you how many times I've seen The Mist, because it's more than I would even like to say. So we're going to get into it. Here's the plot. This book starts with a very bad storm. Now, it's a scary storm. Just like I was saying in the intro, it's very loud, it's violent, it's scary. And our main character, David Drayton, played in the movie by Thomas Jane, was looking out of his window at the lake. And he talks about how the lake reminds him of the ocean because it's so violent with waves. It's so, they're coming up and crashing over the rocks, and it looks completely different than he's used to it seeing. They have to take some shelter. Him and his wife. His wife's name is Stephanie, played in the movie by Kelly Collins Lentz. They're terrified. It looks like a rough one. He's going to get some candles. They're going to take their son, Billy, played in the movie by Nathan Gamble. They're going to go down into the basement and just wait this out. It's a little rough. They're not sure what's going to happen here. So let's go under. The book spends a good bit of time building this storm up, showing you how intense it is. It reminds me of the beginning of Twister. It's a very intense scene. And storms can definitely be scary, especially when you're a kid. David's not a kid, but they still make me feel that way. The movie skips over a lot of this. The movie starts, David is he's an artist. He's painting a photo. There's a storm happening. The title shot is over an image of the family looking out the window at the storm. We get a tree smashing through a window, and then we just cut to the next morning. So the movie's ready to just get into it. Something in the book that I thought was cool is that David sees a cyclone out on the water, and he mentions it a few times, and it comes up later on. It's just this image that I thought was cool, like a water spout happening in your backyard. That's scary. Tornadoes are scary. Anyway, the storm fucks a lot of shit up. It takes down the boathouse, smashes their window. There's a tree through their kitchen. Their neighbor has a lot of damage done in his yard. One of his vehicles is wrecked. Now, the neighbor, his name is Brent Norton, played by Andre Bauer in the movie, and he is great in this role. But anyway, Brent and David have had a history together. You kind of learn about it here and there, bits and pieces. They've had property disputes. They do not like each other. There's definitely a tension built up between these two men. And it's played very well in the film. It's a great dynamic. But because this damage is happening, these two got to play nice. They're sort of friendly today. And, you know, Brent needs a ride into town. So he is going to ride to town with David and Billy to get some supplies. Now, before that happens, they do notice across the lake the mist coming in. They can see it. They think it's weird. There's a conversation between David and Stephanie, and she's like, well, what is that? Oh, well, it's the mist. Coming over the lake like that? We've had mist over the lake before. It's left over from the storm. It's immediately eerie. Immediately you know that this doesn't seem right. And at first David kind of tries to play that off, but he gets it in his head. He knows that there's something weird here. The mist has an eerie, like, color to it. It's a non-reflective, solid white, and it looks like it's in a straight line. Now, in the movie, they take out the whole straight line thing, and it's just mist. The fact in the book that it is a straight across line makes it 10 times crazier to me and would instantly be an indicator that something is wrong here, because that's not what mist or clouds or fog does. So the mist is coming. They're going to go into town, and David has this, he has kind of a, he's a little scared. He's got this ominous feeling, and he tries to tell Stephanie to come with him. He's like, hey, why don't you come with us? And she doesn't want to, because she doesn't want to be around Brent. She says, no, I'm going to stay. I'm going to do some work. So we take off. We're going to the store. There's moments of finding out some of the radio stations are down. In the movie, the military is driving by. Brent and David have a conversation about the Arrowhead project that is going to randomly come up here and there. It comes up in the book, I think maybe more than it does in the movie. But you get a feeling right away that whatever the Arrowhead project is maybe responsible for this entire thing. So now we're in the store. And listen, you guys have all lived through a pandemic. We're all in this together. We know what it's like to go to a supermarket during a crisis or during a time where people think that they really need all the goddamn toilet paper. And so they're in the store. People are trying to get their stuff. They're checking out. It's a little hectic. There's no power. There's a lot of people here, and the movie does a really great job at making this seem real to me. There's a lot of banter and just small conversations between characters. It just seems like stuff that you would have in your everyday life. You know, David talks to one of the women working a register, and she's like, hey, me and Steph want a date night. Can you babysit on Thursday? And she's like, sure, got it. You know, just stuff like that, simple stuff. They're taking turns getting their stuff. Brent's getting his own stuff. It's all happening. You do see some military guys come into the store. And David's very aware of his surroundings. He sees that. He's watching. Then you get some sirens going off. Some police sirens. And everybody's a little on edge. Everybody's looking out, wondering what's going on. And then we hear some fire sirens. There must be a fire. Billy immediately says, is mommy okay? He's worried about his mom. And David says, she's fine. What you doing, Sally? People are starting to heighten a little bit. They're starting to look out the windows. They're wondering what all this noise is. You got the military speeding by. It starts to become uncomfortable. And then you get this man. His name is Dan Miller. Played in the movie by Jeffrey DeMunn. He's a great actor. He's in a lot of, you'd recognize him from tons of stuff. Look him up. He's running through the parking lot, hysterical. He's screaming. There's blood on his shirt, on his face. He's freaking people out. Everybody immediately sees him. They're running to the door. What is happening? He's screaming. He runs into the store. He's yelling to shut the doors. Something in the mist took John Wayne. What does he mean by that? What does he mean, something in the mist? What does he mean, took? What took John Lee? So they're trying to calm him down. They're talking to him, and then the mist rolls in. comes in right behind him, completely envelops the parking lot, and then it hits the supermarket. People freak out. Some people run into it. Some people are trying to run to their cars, trying to get out of here before whatever is happening happens. And some people don't make it. You hear screams. You hear muffled screams. You can't see more than 3 or 4 feet in front of you. It's almost a complete panic here. Nobody knows what these people are screaming at, okay. Why they're screaming. They're freaking out about this man who just ran in with blood on him. And then there's like an earthquake, basically. The entire supermarket shakes, things fall, there's glass shattering. People are very scared at this point. Nobody knows what's happening. Finally calms down. There's theories. One man thinks maybe it was a poisonous gas explosion. Nobody's sure. At this point, David, he wants to get some pads for his son. He wants to keep him comfortable, try to keep him calm. He gets told that there's some stuff back towards the loading dock area that he can get. So he's heading back there. And, you know, he walks in and the generator is all, it's smoking, it's clogged, so he shuts it off. He's about to walk out of the loading dock when he hears a noise come from outside. It's the scraping noise. There's something pressing up against the door, pushing, trying to get in the door. And whatever it is, judging from the sound, it's very big. It's pushing. It's frightening to him, so he turns around to get out of here. And he runs into Ollie Weeks, who's played by Toby Jones. He runs into Jim, who is played by William Sadler, who plays Death in Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. He's great in this movie, and he's great in everything he's in, so check that guy out. And he runs into Myron, tells them what's happening. Hey, did you guys hear that sound? Hear what sound? Brings them in the back. They're trying to figure out what's up with the generator. And then Norm, the bag boy's like, hey, you guys get this door open? I'll go out there and unclog it. To which Ollie and David are like, hey, maybe that's not a good idea. And he's like, whoa, you think we can't do it? You think we don't know how to fucking clean the generator? And he's like, listen, that's not the reason. I'm not saying you can't do it. I'm saying maybe it's not the smartest thing to go out into this mist where people are screaming and we don't know what it is. Maybe just chill the fuck out for a minute. Dan said there's something in the mist. Maybe don't go out there. And they're just like, no, hey, they're mad at this. They're like, David, shut the fuck up. Let us do it. They're just going to do it. They don't care. So they turn the generator on. The door opens. And Norm is he's like, oh, I told you there's nothing out here. And then what happens? But we get tentacles. We get some tentacles come under, sliding through the mist, grabbing Norm. They grab him by the ankle. They're trying to pull him out. The suckers have teeth. So they're like ripping his flesh off and eating it as they're trying to pull him out. More tentacles come in. David is the only one trying to help because Jim and Myron are just fucking terrified of what they're seeing. Finally, they come. They try to help. Ollie gets an axe. More and more tentacles. And then some of them are huge. Some of them are so insanely large. Norm doesn't make it. The tentacles get him. They rip him apart. They pull him out. He's never heard from again. So they don't know what to do here. They leave the back room. They change clothes. David's like, don't tell anybody. We gotta figure out how to do this. He tries to tell Brent first. Brent doesn't believe him. Brent thinks he's playing a joke on him. This starts to cause trouble. Brent almost gets into a fight with David. He calls them hicks. He brings up the property dispute. I'll sue you again. This time I'll win. I'm glad my tree smashed your boathouse. Smashed it really good, didn't it? Fantastic. Tentacles from Planet X is what he calls them. From the sounds of it, the tentacles are coming out of the beer cans. Nobody believes it until they get a couple other characters to walk in the back, see the damage, see the blood, see a piece of a tentacle that was cut off. But still, some people don't believe it. You can throw as much cow's blood around the back as you want to, says Brent. They don't quite believe it. Half the people do. They start trying to stack some dog food because the whole front of the store is glass. So they're stacking bags of dog food to just try to enforce it here. Now, this whole time, we have another character, Miss Carmody, and she's preaching to people. She's a very religious person. She's preaching about the end of times. She's a little crazy. And at this point in the story, everybody thinks she's crazy. There's a couple times she pops up and everybody's giving her this look. Everybody's like, okay, that's enough. Can we stop talking here? Anyway, so Brent and his little group of people here, they decide they're going to leave. They're just going to get in their vehicles and they're going to take off. To them, there's no proof of any creatures, of any wrongdoing. They think that there's jokes being played on them. They're not buying into any of this bullshit. So they're just going to get out of there. They're not going to be safe sitting in a store. The only thing to do is to get up and do it yourself. So they're going to take off. David asks if he would put a rope around his waist just to kind of see how far they would get. He doesn't do it, but another guy says, "Hey, I'm going to go get a gun out of the truck. I'll do it." Well, that doesn't really go too well, and the rope starts to shoot out really fast. People are trying to hold it. It gets, tossed up in the air, so it's, whatever the rope is attached to is high off the ground. It falls. There's slack. They start pulling it back in, and then all of a sudden, it's covered in blood, and they're pulling in this rope, and it's just covered in blood, and it's dripping, and then they finally see, once it gets close enough through the fog, that they're just pulling in the lower half of this man. Whatever is out there ripped his body in half. His intestines are hanging out, and they're just pulling his legs back towards the store. Now, when people see this, they freak out. Again, there's a lot of freaking out in this movie. There's a lot of chaos. Close the door, cut the rope, get it out of here. What are we going to do? Who knows? So that night, there's still people stacking dog food. They got a little grill going, gas grill. They're making food for everybody. Everybody's trying to just make the best of it and hang out. They got lights on. Now, in the night, there are bugs attracted to the lights. Now, these aren't normal bugs. They're creatures from the mist. They're big. I think the book describes them as being about 2 feet long. They start coming to the glass. Everybody's watching. What are these? They're creepy looking things. They're attracted to the light. But then there are these bigger creatures that are swooping in because they're attracted to the bugs. They're trying to eat the bugs. They're like pterodactyl type creatures. They're like mutant dinosaurs, basically. They start hitting the glass to catch the bugs, and it's breaking the glass. It shatters. Bugs get in. These pterodactyl things get in. It is complete chaos here. People are freaking out. They're screaming. They're trying to get these things out of here. There's all these makeshift weapons. People have broomsticks. Somebody decided that maybe it was a good idea to set the end of a broom on fire or a mop on fire to try to beat these things out of here. Ollie has a gun. There's one gun that a woman, Amanda Dunfray, had in her purse. So Ollie has a gun. He's trying to shoot these things without hitting anybody. There's bugs stinging people. Their necks are swelling up. Pterodactyls are landing on people and ripping their necks out. It's grisly. It's a scene of horror, and it's insane. Now, in the book here, there is a woman who breaks her leg somehow. Now, in the movie, they change the woman with the broken leg to somebody who's trying to light one of these mops on fire. He just lights himself on fire. So you have a person who's hurt. It's this, the same end game here, but your injuries are different. In this, in the commotion here, something else that happens that is not in the book, but one of these bugs lands on Miss Carmody. And it walks over her body a little bit. She kind of puts her hands up and she starts praying. She's praying to God and she's saying, "My life for you, your will be done." The insect does not sting her. It flies off of her and it flies away. And some people see this. And this kind of lends her a little bit of, you know, legitimacy. People see this and they're like, oh, maybe this woman is not as crazy as we thought she was. And she starts to amass this, like, small following. So all the days when nothing's happening, you got this woman just preaching. This is what happens. We did this, you know. This is God's wrath. She's insane. So the next day, you got a broken window. You got a lot of people that are hurt. You have Miss Carmody and her little flock kind of growing. You have this one guy who, you know, burned a severe part of his body. And he's not dead, but he's begging to be shot. He's like, please just kill me. Give me the gun and I'll do it myself. There's no medicine. The supermarket has nothing but like Advil in it. So David, you know, starts talking about maybe trying to get out of here. Maybe we need to go to the pharmacy, and then maybe we need to look beyond just going to the pharmacy, and we got to figure out how to get out of here. This is something that's a little different from in the book. The same conversation happens, but in the book, somebody is telling these things to David. It's somebody else's idea, but David's our hero. David's our main character. So in the movie, we give all this info to him to say. Now, one thing I do want to say about David, as played by Thomas Jane, is when I saw this movie, it made me think. Now, my favorite movie of all time is Jaws. I just think it's the greatest movie ever made. And it's one of those movies that, of course, I would never want to see it be remade. The characters in that movie, Brody, Hooper, and Quint, are perfect. They're all perfectly acted. But when I saw this movie, this character, the character played by Thomas Jane, it's very Brody-like to me. He very much seems like he's thrust into a situation a little bit above his head, but he's doing the best he can at taking care of it. And I got a lot of, you know, Brody feels from this performance, and it's great. But anyway, he starts thinking like, hey, at some point we might need to get the fuck out of here, but first let's go to the pharmacy. It's very close. We can just jump in, get what we need to get, and we can get back out. So they make the plan. They're going to go to the pharmacy. And at first, guess what? Miss Carmody doesn't want them to go. She says, you're all going to die out there. Whatever. They go anyway. Now, I want to say before we go any further, like, I did say there's going to be some differences between the book and the movie, and that I would jump back and forth. But I want to tell you, honestly, a lot of it's really the same. There's a pretty big difference that we'll get to for the ending. But other than that, most of the differences in this are just, you know, maybe some different characters get the dialogue that another character got. There's, you know, you get your main cast of people, but then beyond that, it's kind of unimportant. So there are a few things here and there that are added in. There's a third military guy that we'll get to that's not in the book, and he kind of has a major scene that is not in the book. And then there's an MP who's going to be in this next pharmacy section, who's in the movie, not in the book again. But other than that, the only differences you're getting is maybe a few things happen in a different order, or maybe a different character says this line or that line. But other than that, this is a pretty straightforward adaptation, which is one of the great things about it. So anyway, we get into the pharmacy. They're looking for medicine. David promised his son he would grab him a comic book. He's just really trying to keep that kid chill because, like, who would be at this situation? So there are spider webs all over the pharmacy. At first, they don't realize it. And it's the same when you're watching the movie. They're all over, but it's almost like, what is that? What is happening? I can't tell. They left the door open, so you know something is going to be in here. But they don't see any bodies at first. And then they start hearing things. They're trying to get the medicine. Everybody's got a bag. They brought this older character named Irene with them because she knows where they keep the heavy-duty medicine for burns and that sort of thing. And then the book it, instead of going for the burns, they're going for the person who has the leg injury. So it's the same outcome, but for a slightly different reason. So anyway, the MP, the military MP, they find him. He is strung up. He's covered in spider webs. He's still alive. He's saying things like, "It's our fault. It's our fault." They're like, "Whoa, okay, this is scary." Spiders start to pop out of his face and his skin. He falls on the ground, and when he hits the ground, his body just explodes with spiders. So that's great. These spiders are very scary looking. Their faces are sort of humanoid looking, and they shoot these webs that are sort of acidic. They hit the ground, and you can see that you can hear the psss, and there's steam rising up. And one spider shoots a web around this guy's leg, and it burns through his pants and his, you know, a couple layers of skin and maybe some muscle, and it just slides down his leg, just revealing red, just blood and muscle and whatever's under your skin, you know? It's very disgusting. Everybody's trying to knock these spiders on them. There's something that the book does a little later that I really liked, and when they're kind of describing these spiders, they kind of make it a point to say, hey, these aren't even, this is not even really a spider. It's spider-like, but maybe it's got 12 legs. Maybe it's got 14 legs. The face is kind of humanoid. None of these creatures are anything that we have in our world. Everything you see here is very Lovecraftian, nightmarish, horrific versions of whatever we have. So we're going to call it a spider. They call it a spider, but it's just some sort of creature that resembles a spider, which, you know what, is a lot like Stephen King's It. Whenever you get to the end of that book, spoilers, I'm sorry, go read that shit. Pennywise also, his original, or the form that can be perceived by humans is kind of a giant spider, but they also say, like, this is not a spider, this is just spider-esque monstrosity. So anyway, we get out of the pharmacy, we fucking run out of there, we get back to the supermarket, we get in, and of course, you know, they left with seven people, they came back with like three. Miss Carmody's like, yeah, duh, that's what I told you was gonna happen. So they get back and they're like, we gotta find these soldiers, because that MP said, this is our fault. We need to know what they're talking about. They go to look for the soldiers. Remember, there are three of them. At this point, you got one left. Two of the soldiers have hung themselves. They could not take what was happening. They're kind of responsible. Not them personally, but we get the soldier that's left. They take him in front of Miss Carmody. And we get chaos again. We start to get more yelling. We start to get more fighting. It's his fault. He's the reason. He's the reason. That's what brought down the wrath of God. The scientists were studying these other dimensions at the Arrowhead Project, and they thought they built a window to another world, but maybe your window turned out to be a door. This kind of thing. Miss Carmody has got this guy on his knees. She's yelling at him. She's preaching at him. And she says, hey, this is your fault. And now you need to be sacrificed for this. It gets crazy here. At this point in the book and in the movie, Miss Carmody has more people on her side than David does on his. Most of the people are frightened and scared, and they're drinking the Kool-Aid, and they saw the bug not kill her, and the things that she is saying is starting to make sense to too many people. So there's not a lot that David and Amanda and Ollie and Dan, there's not a lot that these people can do. They're being held back, and at some point the butcher just stabs this soldier right in the stomach, stabs him multiple times, three or four times. It's all like getting insane. People are yelling. They lift him up into the air. And Miss Carmody yells, "Feed him to the beast! Let the abomination smell his blood!"
It's insane. So they're carrying this man to the door, forcibly throwing him out of the supermarket, just into the mist, onto the ground. This has only been like 2 days. If that, a day and a half. And people have completely lost their minds to the point where they think, let's just sacrifice somebody. Let's just stab this fucking dude in his stomach and throw him to whatever is in the mist. And this crowd of people are all pressed up against the glass, and they're smiling as a large monster creeps in, a shadow in the mist, and takes its victim. The beast will leave us alone tonight. Tomorrow, well, we'll just have to wait and see. Miss Carmody has lost her mind. What little bit of her mind she had, this like power is rushing to her head. She may be at this point more dangerous than whatever is in the mist. And that's, you know, maybe that's the point of this entire story. Maybe that's what this story is about. It's about fear. It's about how people, you know, can just fall apart. It's about morality and the good and the bad and what people will flock to when they don't know what to do. So some time has passed since the sacrifice. And they decide they got to get out of here. They just got to. Their crowd, Miss Carmody's crowd, is bigger than them. They're just going to keep sacrificing people. Do you stay in there and wait for her craziness? Or do you just make a run for it? They put a plan together. Ollie gets some groceries. He hides them up at the front. They pick a time, and they're like, we're just going to sneak out of here. It's a small group of people. Maybe, I think it's 8 people, something like that. So they try to get out, and Miss Carmody's waiting on them, stealing food. She doesn't want them to go. Again, chaos breaks out. There's fights. There's punches being thrown. They're trying to not let them go. Like, at this point, why? Who cares? If you're at the point where you're sacrificing people, just let them fucking go. Ollie shoots Mrs. Carmody. He kills her. Shoots her in the head. She falls down. Her followers are yelling at him, "You murdered her." There's this funny moment that it's in the book and it's also in the movie, but Ollie's like, "I shot her." And David's like, "Thank you." And then Ollie says, I wouldn't have done it if there wasn't any other way. And David's like, "That's why I said thank you." Just the way he delivers that line. That's why I said thank you. It's very funny to me. So our group of 8 or so people get out, and instantly some of them are kind of turned around. The mist, they can't see. Ollie is killed by a giant creature. This scene in the book I thought was even better than it is in the movie, because the way it's described, Ollie drops his gun. And when the gun flash goes off, in the instant of the flash, David sees these 2 big dark eyes of this creature. And it's just so quick. It's in the instance of a gun flash. And it pulls Ollie in, rips him apart, rips him in half. The spiders get a few people. But eventually you get your characters into David's vehicle. Now, in the movie, you got David, his son Billy, Dan, Amanda, and Irene. In the book, it's a little different. I think maybe there's just one less person. It's still him and Billy and I think 2 other people. So the first thing they do is David's like, "We're going to go home. I want to find my wife. Get her in the car so we can get the fuck out of here." And this also differs in the book. The roads are blocked. He cannot get to He just can't get home. There's shit in the way. The roads are gone. It's impossible for him to even get to his home. He doesn't know what he can do. The only thing he can do is to just keep driving. So it's kind of unsure of the fate, but it's also strongly implied, like, hey, she's, you know, there was no window in your house. She's probably dead. In the movie, they make it very clear that she's dead. He drives right up to the house, and there she is, strung up in a bunch of spider webs, trying to, just where he left her, basically, trying to work on some stuff and fix the house up a little bit. So that is a little bit of a difference. And now there's nothing left to do but to drive. The plan here is to just drive until they're out of gas. Go as far as they can and hope that they get past the mist. They're driving a couple hours here. Something the book does that I wish was in the movie a little more is that they do encounter many creatures on their drive here. They see a variety of things, weird, Lovecraftian, just almost indescribable things flying around them, tentacles in the road, all kinds of scary stuff. But one of the things that is in the movie, that is in the book here that I really like, is this giant creature. It's very big, so big. David in the book says, or he's thinking, I don't think there are any creatures on Earth that were as big as this. Billy asks if it was a dinosaur. It's six-legged. Anytime it takes a step, the vehicle shakes. There's other smaller creatures around it, almost as if it's its own ecosystem. It's very big and scary. It doesn't give a fuck about them or their car. It's just taking a little leisurely stroll through Earth. Who knows how many more of those things there are out here? Who knows if that's even the biggest of them? This one was so tall that they mention they can't even see the underside of its belly. All they can see are the six legs coming up and down, hoping that they don't get stepped on. So this is where we're hitting the big difference here. We'll go ahead and talk about it. Now, in the book, they know their gas is going to be gone soon. But David is sort of hopeful, and he starts thinking back about listening to the radio and how he caught one word, or he thinks he caught one word. At this point, it's almost hard to tell. Did he actually hear this? Is he going a little crazy? He says, you know, this book ends with him saying, I'm going to whisper two words in my son's ear, hope and Hartford. So they're saying that he heard the word Hartford on the radio, and his hope is that if he heads there, there's safety there. And some people think that this is a hopeful ending. But when I read it, it kind of seems like maybe David's going a little crazy. It's less hopeful and a little more delusional to me because, first of all, like I said, who knows if he actually even heard that word? And then if he did, he only heard one word. What makes him think that that means in Hartford, everything is fine? Who knows? So the book ends with the mist still there. There's still creatures. Who knows how far this mist has gone? It could be the entire world. It could be the United States. It could be a couple states. Who knows? We don't know. We don't know if it's going to go away. We don't know if there are scarier things that they haven't even encountered yet. To me, that's not a hopeful ending. Now let's move on to the movie ending. The movie ending just kind of takes it a little bit further. And I don't think it's a widely different ending. Honestly, this ending is almost as if Stephen King were to just write five more pages, maybe this is what we would have gotten. And Stephen King has come out and said that he likes this ending. And if he would have thought of it, he would have maybe added it. Now, in the book, there is a line. It's a quick kind of afterthought, but there is a line where David is thinking to himself. He's got the gun, the one gun they have. He's got it in his hand, and he looks. He's counting back how many shots were taken when they left. You know, they were shooting at the creature. They were shooting at the spiders. He's making a mental note at how many shots were taken and how many bullets are left in that gun. And he has the thought that there are 3 bullets left in that gun. There are 4 people in this car. And if I have to, I'll figure my own thing out myself. And then they move on. But that line insinuates that if it comes down to it, David, they could just kill themselves, and then David will figure out, you know, his own thing. But that, it's not explored in the book. It's left sort of ambiguous. And I think that's why the director here, Frank Darabont, took it into his hands to build upon that specific line of dialogue in this ambiguous ending. And in the movie version, they run out of gas. There's 5 people in the car, and that includes Billy. They run out of gas. They're sitting there for a few minutes or whatever, mulling it over. He kind of looks at everybody. They kind of shake their head, yes. We cut to outside of the car. Well, first of all, you get a shot of Billy waking up and looking at his dad in horror because his dad is pointing a gun at his face. And then David shoots. He uses the 4 remaining bullets, and he shoots the 4 people left in the car. And then there's not one for him. And he becomes hysterical. He's crying. He's freaking out. He's putting the gun in his mouth and, you know, dry firing it because there's no bullets. And, he, you know, he's in pain. His wife is gone. He just had to murder his son because that's better than getting ripped apart by a creature. I think I would maybe rather get killed by a creature. Don't you think it would be cool to be a person who's like, oh, well, you know, how did Jake go out? Oh, well, he died in his sleep. It's kind of boring. Or, oh, you know, somebody shot him. He was murdered. Or, dude, Jake was ripped apart by some otherworldly tentacle creature that ate him as it was pulling his limbs from limb. Like, that to me is a little more badass of a way to go. Yeah, it might be painful, but it's got to be cool, right? Anyway, so, yeah, Thomas Jane, David Drayton, he killed all these people, and he leaves the car, and you hear creatures, you hear the roaring of something big, and he's like, fuck it, come get me, come kill me, let's get this over with. But then what was making the noise shows up, and it's a tank, and there's some military men on it, and the mist starts to dissipate, and it goes away, and the military is here, and they're driving through, and there's a truck full of survivors, and there's people with flamethrowers, and they're kind of killing the bugs and what's left, and it's just this, like, gut punch of an ending where, like, you know, if he would have waited, if, you know, another minute, they could have been saved. And, you know, I was having a conversation with a friend of mine about the ending of this, and they were like, well, you know, I don't like the ending because it's just like, he could have just waited 5 minutes and it would have been fine. Why didn't they just wait? Why'd they do it immediately? Well, here's why they did it immediately. Because they just spent 2 days trying not to be murdered by bugs, acidic web-spewing spiders, tentacles that have suckers with teeth on them that's attached to something that they don't even know what it's attached to. These giant crab-like creatures, those pterodactyls, Mrs. Carmody from being sacrificed, and then they got in their vehicle, they finally got out of there, and they drove. We don't know how long they drove. It's a movie. You can't show us how many hours they were in the car. They had a full tank of gas. They started in Maine. I believe there's a scene where they drive under a Pennsylvania sign. Did they drive all the way to New York to Pennsylvania? That's like 8 hours. They've been in this car encountering monsters, creatures. David sees his dead fucking wife half eaten by spiders in a giant spider web. They're out of gas. How fucking long do you want them to wait before they decide, hey, let's get this over with? Like, this is enough. So that's how it ends. It ends with David. He's alive. He's freaking the fuck out. He's just killed these people, including his son. And the mist is gone. Now, I don't know. I've always preferred the movie ending because I feel like that kind of an ending, it's important. It is important for some films to have those awful, horrific gut punches. You don't see the kid die a lot of times in movies. And I'm not saying that I like to see kids die. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying, like, if you're going to pull your punches and make a piece of art and make a film and you don't give a fuck about, you know, this status quo of, like, the kid's always got to live. No, the kid doesn't always have to live, because sometimes kids die. Sometimes monsters eat the heroes. Sometimes fucked up shit happens, and I like that. This whole movie is intense. It's fucking relentless. It's so hard. It's gory. It's a lot to get through. It's brutal, and the ending shouldn't be any different. So I like that about the ending. The thing that I like better in the book ending is that there's seemingly no end to the mist. You don't know. It could be forever. Like, you get to kind of make it up, and you can sit here and think, like, yeah, maybe in this book the world's gone. The mist is everywhere. In the movie, you know, at least they've somehow taken care of it. So yeah, that's the fucking movie, man. I'm kind of, you know, I was a little surprised that this even got made like this, because this is not the kind of movie, especially with the kid dying at the end, you wouldn't think a major, you know, production company or film company or whatever would put this out, but they did. And Frank Darabont was very adamant that that ending got made. He did not want to change that. He didn't want, you know, a lot of times movies will get made and then at the end they'll say, we got to change the ending, and they do a reshoot, and then that's fucking it. And it doesn't matter what your director thought. It just happens. So he was very adamant that that happened, and he made a deal that he would shoot the movie on a lower budget if he could keep that. And he did, and he ended up he took a lower budget, and he also had to have the movie done in like 3 weeks or something like that. Like 3 weeks from beginning of shooting to end, it was done, which that's pretty crazy. One of the things I really love about this movie is that a lot of it is word for word the book. I reread the book yesterday and rewatched the movie yesterday, and so much of the dialogue is just straight up out of the book, and I like that. It shows me that Frank Darabont, and you know, it shows me that Frank Darabont cares. He cares about this book. He cares about Stephen King, and we all know Frank Darabont has also made Shawshank Redemption. He made The Green Mile. He is, him and Mike Flanagan may be the only two movie directors out there that are adapting Stephen King, because they love Stephen King. Movies get made for all different kinds of a reason. And sometimes a company is like, we need to buy a Stephen King property and just make it. And it just gets made. And maybe the people are fans and maybe they do love it, but they don't care enough maybe about the story. Every Stephen King adaptation that Frank Darabont and Mike Flanagan have made, I think that's only maybe five movies in total, but out of those five, they are very true to the story. Like, you can tell they get Stephen King. They love it. They love these stories. He adapted it for a reason, not just because he thought he could make money off it. He loved The Mist, and he wanted to put it on screen, and he fucking did, dude. He made this movie, and I think it is a perfect example of a Stephen King adaptation. Now, they filmed this movie in Louisiana. I looked it up on MapQuest. It's only 11 hours for me. Am I gonna drive to an abandoned supermarket to see the filming location of this movie? Maybe I could do that in a weekend. Who knows? One of the things that I like about this movie, other than everything I've been saying over the past, I don't know how long, hour, I could have been talking about this movie for 3 hours and I wouldn't be able to tell. So I'm sorry if this is long. I don't know. This movie feels very real to me. And I think it's a mixture of keeping it very direct from the book. A lot of the dialogue seems real, especially in the beginning before the mist shows up. It just all feels relatable. The characters feel like real small town people. And there's something about the way this movie is shot. And it feels like you're there. You're very close to it. It feels almost like a documentary. They got some cameramen who work a lot on TV, and their cameras are on these rigs where they can move around really fast. It makes it feel more personal. And Frank Darabont would block the scene, but the camera work was all mainly improvised. So he would block the actors, tell them how he wanted them to do it, but then he would just film. He would just say, roll it. And he would let the two cameramen improvise around the action. They were kind of in the scenes. The director, the cameraman, and the actors all kind of built this together. You can look up on YouTube. There's some stories of the making of this movie, and they talk about how at times the cameraman would kind of nudge other actors out of the way so they can get in on the action. And then there were scenes where, like, Thomas Jane says, like, he knew he was about to do something, so he would kind of pull a cameraman close to him for a scene that was about to happen. Everything was very kind of spontaneous. And I think that's a very unique way of filming a movie. And it's definitely, for a horror film like this, if you really want to feel like you're in there, that's the best way to go, I think. They did something good there. I highly recommend this book, this movie. The audiobook is also great. I've listened to the audiobook. There is an adaptation that they came out with called The Mist in 3D Sound. I think this came out maybe in the early 90s, maybe, or maybe in the late 80s. And it's kind of an abridged version of the book, but it's acted out. There's different actors reading each part. There's sound effects and stuff, you know. And it's very fun. It's very fun, but the kid, whoever's playing the kid, is a little annoying. His voice is a little annoying. I'm sorry. He's a kid, but, you know, he's crying a lot. He's screaming a lot. You got to be careful with that stuff. Stephen King likes the ending to the movie. He likes how nihilistic he is. I agree. I think this is good. I want to thank all of you people for listening to just me rant about this horrible, awful, scary, gross movie. I love it, and I hope you watch it. I hope you read it. I hope you learn something about the morality of man, the scales of good and evil, and how they tip and turn. And I hope you learn something about yourself. Watch this. If you're seeing yourself in Miss Carmody, then maybe you got some problems there. If you see yourself in David, that's a good thing. I think it's definitely one of those movies where you go back and forth. You don't know where you lie, what's good, what's evil. I'm going to leave you guys with this, okay? Mrs. Carmody thought that sacrifice was the way to gain her God's favor. She preached it to the watcher, to the reader. She's clearly insane. She used her Bible in a perverse way, is a tool to rally the weak-minded into believing that she was the voice of God. She wanted to sacrifice Billy. And she said that that was the only way to drive these creatures away. David kills 4 people, including his son, Billy. Seconds later, the mist clears. Was Mrs. Carmody right all along?